Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi folks, Michael here. Welcome back to another one of our special interview episodes here on Ghibliotech. I love how this year we've been able to use the podcast as a platform to hear from all sorts of filmmakers working within animation, and this week is no exception to that. I'm thrilled to welcome onto the pod Pablo Berger, or Berger, director of Robot Dreams, which is in UK cinemas this week. Robot Dreams premiered at Cannes last year and has been on an amazing journey ever since. It picked up one of the best film prizes at Annecy, as well as Best Animated Film at the European Film Awards, Best Animated Feature at the Annies as well. It was also nominated for an Oscar and has the rare honour of losing to Hayao Miyazaki and The Boy and the Heron. So this chat has been a long time coming. For context, I interviewed Pablo a number of times last year. I had the chance to host Q&As with him at the London Film Festival, where Robot Dreams screened, but it's such a treat to finally welcome him onto the pod to talk about the experience of making his first animated feature after making three live-action films, Torremolinos 73, Blancanieves, and Abracadabra. As always, let's start with a blurb from the distributor. Dog is lonely. He spends a lot of time by himself, whiling away long evenings in his Manhattan studio apartment, eating microwave meals for one in front of the TV. Tired of his solitary existence, he decides to purchase a friend. When his order arrives, he builds Robot, a fun-loving, happy-go-lucky companion to keep him company. Dog and Robot spend an idyllic day together, frolicking through the city to the joyful melody of Earth, Wind and Fire's September, but they are soon separated on the beach. Dog, devastated at the loss of his friend, does everything in his power to get Robot back. What a magical moving film this is. A wordless wonder, and one that's really stuck with me and Jake since we saw it last year. It so delicately explores themes of friendship, loss, memories, dreaming, and how, as we go through our lives, people and places we love come in and out of view, and moving on from them is sometimes tragic but a necessary part of life. Jake and I have both written and talked about this film a number of times over the last few months. If you're a Patreon supporter, you can scroll back through our Library Cafe feed to the episode where we delivered our first reactions to watching the film after we saw it back in October at the London Film Festival. On the writing side, you can find a feature by me with input from Pablo and Benoit Ferrimont on the Curzon website. I also reviewed the film for Little White Lies, and spoilers, I like this film a lot, and I highly recommend that you go and catch it in cinemas while it's screening. Anyway, enough from me. Let's hear from Pablo Berger. Pablo, it's a pleasure to speak with you. First of all, I want to say congratulations. What a year you've had with Robot Dreams, from Cannes to Toronto, prizes at Annecy, the Annies, European Film Awards, Oscar nomination as well. How has that journey been for you?
Well, it truly has been a roller coaster ride, you know, with the screams, with the laughs. You know, it's been really wild because it started starting in a good step like Cannes, but the ball, as you said, has been growing until getting to the Oscars, and also to make a film that is global with a worldwide release. And that's And that's honestly, that's the biggest prize a director can get. I know we said Cannes, Toronto, and all these festivals and all these awards, but to get to the widest audience, that's what was a romantic director, and I consider myself a romantic director, a storyteller. That's the biggest prize, you know, to opening in UK on the 22nd, you know, to open, you know, just open in Mexico and Argentina and all Latin America. I'm going to Italy next week to start the promotion. Germany, so Australia opens, I don't know, I think in a few weeks. So it's so exciting to see how your film, how Robot and Dog are traveling all over the world.
Have you been surprised by how any of the countries have taken to the film? Like, have they responded to it in a different way to how you expected?
Yes, they do. They have, definitely. There's definitely, the film is understood everywhere. Mm. You know, I think that the fact that it's wordless, non-verbal film, and it's designed that it's not a question of language. It's a question of what the characters do, that you can follow the story. But you see very different response. You know, for example, I was at the Tokyo Film Festival, and I could see that the audience was very quiet during the screening, for example. But it didn't mean that they enjoyed it very much, because they will come to me and they will get on a line and they will come to get a sign and to talk about the film, but in a very private way. And they were very happy. You know, of course, this film is looking to Ghibli and to Japanese, to the animation. And this film definitely connects with Japanese animation. So it was very well received, but the audience was very quiet. But when you show the film in the United States, in Los Angeles, in the Animationist Film, one of those great film festivals, the people were so loud from the beginning, and people will start clapping in different places. And that's very exciting. Or when you see it, I've shown it in some kids festivals, and the kids like following the rhythm of September of Earth, Wind and Fire in place of the song, or just like, so it really varies. And now I'm very surprised, for example, right now, it opened a week ago in Mexico, you know, and it's a gigantic hit in Mexico. It's just in 1 week, it was like over 70,000 spectators saw the film in just the first week. It was in the top 10. And so I'm really looking forward to what's going to happen in UK, you know, and in a way, UK is one of my, you know, and it's not because I'm talking with you, but it's one of my favorite territories to release my film, you know, because the London Film Festival has screened all of my films, my four films. Every time I've been in UK having Q&A, I feel something about the way I tell stories connect with the UK audience. I'm really looking forward to what happens on the 22nd. It's very exciting.
Oh no, I'm so glad that it's finally coming out. I know what you mean. Festivals are one thing, but an actual theatrical release, more people, different types of people will see it. They'll hear about it. I'm definitely part of the crowd that will look at what's screening at festivals. I'll turn up and go to those films. But if it's on in general release, it's a whole new audience. And I wondered, does it change? Because something I'm always fascinated by talking with filmmakers who've had films released worldwide, particularly animated filmmakers, do you feel that the way that different countries respond to animation is different when you go around the world? Like, sometimes it's seen as more family friendly. Sometimes some countries treat it more like art cinema or world cinema. Have you found it like that?
Yes. And in the case of Robot Dreams, definitely we're seeing different campaigns depending on each country, so different audience. But it really depends a lot on the distribution campaign, you know, how the distributors present the film, you know. Because for me, you know, or for all the team that we made Robot Dreams, it's an adult film. Mm. It's a film that definitely cinephiles connect. You know, we open it in Cannes, but definitely we also see that, you know, like mainstream audience that just want to have fun for and go to the multiplex also is working. And it's working with kids very much, but it was not designed for kids, even if it's cartoon-like characters, you know. So kids for me is like an extra. And And so it really depends. Some countries they have trying to target for kids, you know, which for me is always a surprise. We know which I'm happy. I really want all the kids in UK to come and see it. And I, in a way, I want that for the first time, the parents or the grandparents choose the film. You know, normally I think parents and grandparents, they have watched horrible animated film. I'm not going to give any names. But they're horrible animated films that the kids have convinced their parents to go and see. So this is for the first time that the cinephile parents and grandparents, or parents that listen to this program or what read film magazine, they're gonna say, okay, I'm gonna take you to a film that maybe, yeah, I think you're gonna like. So that's exciting that kids are gonna watch this film.
It's definitely a why are you crying, daddy, sort of film. But also, we did a Q&A back in October, and the kids are the people with the best questions. They're sometimes the most philosophical, insightful, pointed viewers, aren't they?
Well, I agree completely. You know, I just made, just before your podcast, I had an interview with questions with the kids, Cool It, you know, and it was like some kind of podcast or interviews, and the questions were so good, you know, and so complex, you know, honestly, definitely. And this is not trying to be like condescending or trying to be nice. No, I'm serious. And I think that connects also with Robot Dreams. You know, Robot Dreams really treats kids as adults. You know, I think there's so many films that they're condescending. They think that kids, that you have to treat them in a different way, that it have to be more simple messages, so it has to be happy endings, so it has to be you know, more simple stories. And I honestly, I think kids evolve. There maybe it has nothing to do like a kid when I was a kid or the kids now. They're like an audiovisual generation. You know, they grew up watching the stories and watching images. So I think they're a very sophisticated audience. So I think it's important that films can be a film that cater to an adult audience, can cater to kids, can watch it too. And that's how it used to be cinema. If we really analyzed a film history, we think about films in the 40s and 50s and 60s, you know, definitely all the classic films. I remember as a kid being 9 years old or 10 years old and watch John Ford and John Huston and Alfred Hitchcock movies. But now it looks like film had to be niche, you know, it's art house cinema, commercial cinema, kids cinema. But in the old days, and you know that, we all know that, all the film lovers know, films were much more open.
I find that sometimes the feedback you get from kids is always the best because you can't lie to them, particularly when there's an element of poetry or allegory or metaphor. They'll always want to go straight through that and say, no, but what does this mean? This doesn't add up.
You're right. You know, they're really sharp. And you know, directors, we, you know, either we are right or wrong, we always have answers, you know, but and sometimes I'm in a Q&A and yeah, they give you a question, and but if I don't answer what they're asking me, they will ask again, okay, but you didn't answer my question, you know. So adults, when I give an answer, it doesn't matter that I answer their question, they just accept that I just said something. But you know, no, kids, you know, kids are smart. And you know, I have it, my kid is big, although and today is Father's Day in Spain. So my kid is 20. So I've been showing films, and I know what is, you know, to have that everyday life with somebody that is growing and seeing how he's changing, you know. So it's definitely, yeah, it's an audience that we have to respect. And we not only respect, we have to nurture, because at the end, this is the future, you know, and we need audience, you know. Directors, we make films for the cinema, and we want to keep, you know, this happening. You know, I don't want films stop being released in cinemas.
Exactly. This is a bit of a tangent, but if you were watching John Ford, Huston, Hitchcock films when you were nine, what films were you sharing with your kid when they were nine?
Many of those. Definitely many from the 70s and the 80s. You know, sometime I would show film like The Spirit of the Beehive, Victoria Edith, which the protagonist is like a little girl. You know, sometimes also like when you show these kind of films, sometimes that you succeed, sometimes you succeed less, but you kind of plant a seed. For example, I remember showing my daughter Spirit of the Beehive when she was the same age as the protagonist. But definitely maybe when she saw it that time, maybe she didn't enjoy it as much as I thought she would, but definitely she would see it again when she was 14. And maybe, and she told me recently that saw it again at the film club and just loved it. So just, I think it's good to show films that maybe when they see it, maybe they don't understand completely, but they just get a feeling. Or I will show Fellini films for sure, like La Strada, you know, one of my favorite films. So, or you can show Kurosawa films like The Seven Samurai. So definitely, and of course, 80, there's a lot of fun 80s American films that you can just not miss. You know, you have Ghostbusters, Gremlins, you know, things like that, which is, it's a sure thing, you know.
I'm taking recommendations here for my kid very secretly, because he's 5.5 and he is really curious. He's also got a bit of a macabre sense of storytelling. He loves scary stories. So actually Gremlins and Ghostbusters, you know, he might be getting towards that level.
You know, we all, you know, Tim Burton always works, you know, I think there's always that. But for example, some of the nice moments that I got with Robo Dreams, because I've been traveling all over the world and doing Q&As. But some of those great moments I had with when I encountered the audience is when a father or mother or grandparents come to me with a 3-year-old or 4-year-old, and they tell me, it's the first film they see in their life, but it has happened many times. Eh?
Mm.
And they will tell me, he hasn't moved from the seat. It's amazing, you know, and for a director, can you be happier than they said for the rest of their life? They would say, oh, the first film that I saw, it was Robo Dreams. You know, it makes me very, very emotional and happy, you know?
Mm. Let's go back to the beginning with Robot Dreams. So this is adapted from the graphic novel by Sarah Varon. Can you take us back to that moment where you thought, I need to make this into a film?
Well, yes. There are two moments. When I discovered the book, and that was 2010, which I loved it. I thought it was funny, surprising, emotional. And I put it on the shelf of my favorite graphic novels. But it was not until 2018, after I had made Blancanieves and Abracadabra, two live-action films, when I took it out one day from the shelf. And this time, when I read it, I felt the same thing that it happened when I read it the first time 8 years before. But this time, when I got to the end, I got really, really deeply emotional. I was completely moved. Mm. When I say completely moved, I was in tears. And I said, like, wow, what's happening here? And of course, I realized why I was in tears, why I was moved. Because I had made substitutions. You know, for me, in the end of the film, it was not Robert and Doug. There are people that I love so much. There are people from my life that I lost and that I missed. Could be, you know, one of my best friends stopped being my best friend. Oh, I lost my mother. So, and I said, wow, because I had never thought about making an animated film in my life.
Mm.
In my life, I love animation. I always know what's happening. I watch, I'm the type of director that I even when Sight and Sound asked me, what is your favorite films? I have to put Spirited Away in my top 10, you know? So not every director puts animation in their top 10, but I really did. So I thought at that moment when I was in tears, I said, wow, there's something there. This end is very, very powerful and it's very, very unique and very, very surprising. So I said, if I want to tell this story, I have to make an animated film, you know? And luckily for me, I have producers that I've been working for many films and they support me and I know they're adventurous. So I knew they were not going to be scared about making an anime. And honestly, I knew they were not even going to be surprised because my career is based on making very different film between them, you know, very unexpected from one to the other. It almost feels that there's no connection, but the connection is that they're unexpected. And they're very different between them. So at the end, when you make four films that they're different, at least visually, definitely there's the DNA and the themes, there's a connection between the themes, but visually they're very, very different between them.
Mm. I'm intrigued because we've spoken before and you've mentioned loving wordless graphic novels and comics. Yeah. And of course, that's what Robot Dreams is. And the film then goes on to be wordless. What do you love about media that is wordless without voice?
Well, the thing is that, as you said, I collect wordless graphic novels, wordless kids' books, you mm-hmm. know, illustration books. I have to go to the origin of why I start collecting. You know, when my daughter was two, three, she didn't know how to read yet, of course. I found these books that they're books without words, and it gave me the opportunity to read books with her because she could just read it without me, or we could invent stories. So definitely I encourage, you know, if there are parents listening to this podcast, I'm sure they are, you know, it's a great tool. I really enjoy to share the moment. And it started like that, like a game. It's not like, and then I realized that there were many. And, you know, and every time I travel all over the world, or just I went to the bookstore. So, and the thing about what I like about wordless is that it gives you space. It really gives you space to make it your own. So it requires more attention. Of course, a book, wordless book, or a film that has no words, it requires more attention, but it has like a reward at the end, a biggest reward. Because you get so much involved in it. And if you like it, it's really, really satisfying. And also when you read wordless book, every frame is like a painting. It's like important, the composition or every detail. And it can be reread. Every time you read it again, oh, you find some new detail. And I think it's the same when you make a film that is wordless and nonverbal. It's just like, for me, every frame is important. Mm-hmm. There's no transition shot. For me, every shot is important. It's like almost like if it's there, it's for a reason, because it's advancing the story. And also, I think it gives the possibility to rewatch. I think I like the ideas that films are like CDs, like records, like vinyls. You know, when I was a teenager, I could put the same vinyl over and over, you know? So I'm not saying that you have to be watching Robot Dreams nonstop, but I think a film that you love admits many viewings. And I would love to think that the film is complex enough and we put 5 years of our work, so it deserves more than one viewing if you like it.
It's such a good way of putting it. One of the most famous, I don't know if this made it to Spain, but one of the most famous children's books and movies that's come out of the UK is The Snowman. And that's wordless, yeah. Both on page and on screen. Raymond Briggs, an absolute master of that form. What other books are on that shelf? Do you have any other film, any other books that come to mind within that wordless collection?
Well, I love The Snowman, you know, and I wrote Raymond Briggs, and as you know, in the film Robot Dreams, there's also a snowman character, so I really feel close, and I think I know that that's one of those beautiful short films, you know. It's, you know, I have many, you know, I'm very close to the shelves. So I'm just, I've got a little pile of books.
Oh, wow.
You know, no, I have many more. This is just like I couldn't bring all of them. But for example, just to say, one of my favorites, all time favorite is Robinson Crusoe.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wordless version from this great Spanish artist called Ajuvel. It won in Bologna when it was published, you know, in the children's fair, book fair for children. No, there are many. I have, like, that's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
I love this Spanish artist called Ana Juan and this book Circus. She's one of my favorite Spanish artists. This is very macabre, but
oh, creepy, yeah.
You know, it's very easy, you know, when you start collecting them, you know, my daughter, she provides me every birthday or Father's Day, you know, she knows that I'm going to be very happy if she finds a wordless book. You know, I'm always going to cherish them.
But let's go back to making this into a film then. So I guess you hadn't worked in animation before. So what's the first thing you do? How do you start making an animated film?
Well, the first thing I did actually is just to talk with the only person I knew in the animation business, a producer called Iván Miñambres, which he's probably, for me, one of the leading European producers of 2D animation. He produced Unicorn Wars, which is Alberto Vázquez. And I know this podcast is about animation lovers, so they should follow Unicorn Wars, Alberto Vázquez. And he also made another film before in Spain, was called Psiconautas, and I think in UK was called probably Bird Boy. But I think for your listeners of this podcast, I really recommend them. So yeah, so the producer of these films, I knew him. So I contacted him and I talked with him, and he had to give me this kind of like one-on-one course or like animation for dummies. And I remember clearly he told me, just get a great art director and get a great animation director. So those are going to be your left and your right hand. And that was my mission. And then I started to kind of like choose, but that's the same in live action. You know, a director is as good as his team. Mm-hmm. So when a director chooses a team, you have to be very careful and you have to really evaluate all the pros and cons when you choose one head of department. So I found Jose Luis Agreda, the director of animation. He just had done Buñuel, I think in English it's called In the Turtle's Labyrinth. I don't know right. if it was released in UK. It won the best European film award the year it was released. It was important. So he was a great choice. He has been with me for all these years, even now. And then I needed a great animation director. And then that's how I, after thinking, talking with many, I decided to go with Benoit Ferremont. He was one of the directors of animation of the Triplets of Belleville, the Sylvain Chomet. He was one of the directors of animation of The Book of Kells from Tom Moore, Cartoon Saloon. So he also came to Spain for a few years. So definitely, apart from my normal collaborators, I was working with the same composer, with the same music editor, with the same editor, of course, with the same producer, the same sound designer. So I had a lot of my team that normally worked with me in live action. These two were amazing choices because they made amazing work and it was a big joy to work with them. And then, of course, there are hundreds of people, you know, as you know, when you look at the end credits of a film, and especially animation film, there's a lot of artists that work in animated film.
When we spoke last year, you mentioned that there was a point where you spoke with Cartoon Saloon. What were those conversations like? Did they give you any advice about how to undertake an animated project?
Well, the thing was that Jose Luis Agreda, the director of animation, once I decided to go with him, you know, some of the financing process started with my producers, and he started working in Cartoon Saloon for a year for a project, for a Disney project. So he was in Cartoon Saloon and somehow he was talking with the producers at Cartoon Saloon, and she said, they're asking, what are you going to do next? Well, I have this film from the director of Blancanieves. Oh, and they got excited. They got curious. I don't know. They were just curious. And then they said, can you send that the script? And we said, no, we don't send scripts. We were very like, no, we don't. But we are willing to go to Kilkenny, to Ireland, to pitch the project. So that's what we did. My producers and myself, we went to Kilkenny, to Ireland. I'm talking about 6 years ago, 5 years ago, 5 years and a half ago. And we pitched the project. And they were like, oh, they were intrigued. They were very intrigued. And then we sent them the script and they loved the script. And then they saw Blancanieves and they loved Blancanieves. So suddenly we're about to start the production. We really, we were, with the deal memos about to, you know, to get the film ongoing. And I even told my daughter and my wife, we're moving to Ireland, you know? And I remember buying a code on sale, like a thick code. They said, "Oh," because I didn't say, "Oh, I need this. Oh, this code is going to be great in Ireland." And I thought it was amazing. I'm going to make an animation film with Cartoon Salon. And then this balloon dream popped suddenly because the COVID, the pandemic, and this deal that it was moving forward, and it was going to be the first film by Cartoon Salon, not directed by Tom or Nora. It was like, it didn't happen. So we're good friends with them. Yeah, we definitely, with Paul and Tom and Nuria, that he was working there. So it was no hard feelings, but suddenly we found ourselves in a very funny situation. We had script, we had the money, but we didn't have an animation studio. So there was two options. Oh, we cancel the project or we create an animation studio. So that's what we did. You know, my producers, that they are very courageous and adventurous and crazy and a local like me, we decided to make a pop-up. We decided to create two pop-up animation studios, just animation studio to produce Robot Dreams. We had to rent offices, buy computers, create a pipeline, get animators from all over Europe. So if you ask me what was the biggest challenge and the most difficult about making this film, that was the most difficult thing. Mm-hmm. More than making the film itself, which of course it was a challenge. The most difficult thing is to create a professional animation studio to make a very complex film like Robot Dreams. It was just to create those two studios, which we opened and we closed. It only was open for the 3 years that it was the production of the film, you know.
When you say the word pop-up, you usually say that when you're talking about clothes shops or street food markets. You don't talk about something as intensive as an animation production. Would you recommend doing that again to any aspiring animators out there?
Well, yes, of course. You know, the results are there. We are so happy with the results. And we went to Cannes and we went to the Oscars, and in between we got so many awards. And so, yes, you know, this is the same as when people say, you know, just make the film, you know, live action, you know, maybe you don't have all the facilities, all the situation, you just decided to make the film. So definitely it's hard, it's very difficult, and definitely the pipeline, you know, and that's the word that I learned in life in animation, that we don't talk about pipeline in live action, but suddenly the pipeline, that was tough to find the process, because it's a complex media, the technology and how you create it. So to create a pipeline, you know, normally animation studios spend years and years to create the pipeline that it works. So that was a difficult process.
Mm. So do you draw?
I draw bad. I draw very bad. As a kid, I loved to draw. I must say, I really had potential. You know, when I definitely loved to draw, and everybody, my parents and my teachers, "Oh, you draw very good." But definitely, I stopped drawing decades and decades ago. But yeah, I was probably the only person in the crew that didn't know how to draw, and I was the director, which is kind of an oxymoron, you know?
Yeah, because right at the very beginning of our podcast, when we started out just talking about the films of Studio Ghibli, we had two directors who had very different approaches. Hayao Miyazaki, who could draw like the best of the world and a great animator. He could do the whole thing himself if he had the time and energy. And then Isao Takahata, who would just draw stick figures in the margins.
Well, when making this film, of course, we were looking at Ghibli. You know, I had all their filmography in my office, and I've seen it so many times. I love what they do. And of course, for me, Miyazaki, we always talk about much more about Miyazaki than Takahata, as you know, and this is like the Beatles, you know, it's, you know, one is Paul McCartney and the other one is John Lennon. You know, it's not one is more important than the other. Ghibli exists because Takahata and Miyazaki, and I think a program like yours, and I'm sure the listeners, so they know it, you know, but But out there, they don't really value Takahata as much as they should. And of course, Miyazaki is the master, but Takahata is a master too, you know. And in my case, I feel closer to Takahata because, of course, first I don't draw. I do stick figures, of course, and I'm a storyteller where the motion is a big part of every film I make from my live action film. And as we know, Takahata, he's a master of emotion, you know. You know, if we think about Grave of the Fireflies, if we think about his TV series, like Heidi, and there's a TV series that in Spain was called Marco, but I think in UK and Anglo-Saxon world was called 3,000 Leagues Far From.
In Search of Mother.
Those two series, emotion is right there, and they were influential in me, you know, as an animation director, which now I'm an animation director as well as a live action director. And of course, you know, if I have to say another one of my favorite Takahata film is like My Neighbor the Yamada.
Yamada's, yes, yeah.
I love that one, and that's also has a lot of big connection with Robert Dreams, which is sometimes their daily life, small things, you know. But Miyazaki, which I love, we all know that his world is closer to fantasy, and he has his own world. And Takahata, it changes depending on the story because he's not an artist, so you know, there's no hard feelings. It's not because Miyazaki has won the Oscar and I haven't won it. No, I love Miyazaki. I don't want the listeners to take me wrong, but I think after all we've been all year round talking about Miyazaki, I think in a podcast like this, it was a good moment to do a little homage to the great Takahata.
Have you seen his film Only Yesterday? Because it's a
Yes.
strange connection, but one of the innovations within that they really focused on was the little micro expressions around the eyes and the face, trying to have very realistic facial features. And even though Robot Dreams is a world full of animals, there is still that focus
Yes.
on dog, for example, when you really feel the pain or the joy of his expression in the just around his eyes or his face.
I've seen Only Yesterday, and I agree with you. I think the acting in Only Yesterday is amazing. I think that's one of the things that I was trying to get on my film. I think if there's one difference, my film from other films that were released this year, or something that I thought I could bring to the animation world is good acting. I have worked with amazing actors in live action, and I think in my live action film, they're really good acting, and I love directing actors. So I love directing animated characters. So of course you have to bring about these pupils and little things and the eyes. For me, when I work with actors, I only look at their eyes. I mean, we talk about anthropomorphic characters. You know, the first film I saw of Miyazaki was Porco Rosso. That's how I discovered his world in the 90s, in the mid-90s. So then I had to discover earlier work. And then after I discovered Porco Rosso, of course, I couldn't miss any of his films in the cinema. But I remember Pompoko of Takahata, which is also is a fantastic film. They're great masters, and I think we, in that sense, I'm very happy. Not that I don't know if the word is happy, you know, to lose the Oscar. Of course, we wanted to win the Oscar, but I'm happy that if somebody had to win the Oscar and it was not Robert Dreams, you know, it had to be the great master Miyazaki, because I think he's an inspiration of a huge generation of animation lovers and animation directors. You know, really, I think we should all send letters or messages to Miyazaki. Please make another film. No, don't. We want more film from Miyazaki.
Did you cross paths with Ghibli on the awards trail? Obviously, he wasn't doing much.
Well, the thing is that Hayao Miyazaki didn't come. You know, we did a lot of panels. Once you are nominated, you start with luncheon nominees, panels. I met all the other directors many times. We had lunch, dinner. We have become friends. I'm talking the directors and producers of Spider-Man, Nimona and Elemental, and me and my producers, We are like a group. But unfortunately, because we would all have loved to meet Hayao Miyazaki, we have seen some of the videos that he has sent. And only at the Annies came some animator from the Ghiblis came to the Annies to get the awards. But no, we haven't been able to have a connection with them. My dream, honestly, because my film Robot Dreams is going to be released in Japan in November. My dream is that it is screened at Ghibli, and my dream it would be that an honor that the master Hayao Miyazaki will watch Robot Dreams, you know. So, you know, sometimes dreams come true. So still many months before November. So our producers, I know, well, our distributors in Japan, definitely they are contacting Studio Ghibli to find the possibility that it's screened at the Studio Ghibli before the release.
Well, Pablo, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. And we have one question that we always end our interviews with. And I apologize for putting you on the spot with this. The podcast that we do, Ghibli Attack, started with a recommendation. And I knew that Jake had never seen any Ghibli films, and I had seen all of them. So I said to him, you need to watch these films. These are great filmmakers. And also, each film adds up to a whole story in its own right. The story of these filmmakers working together. So one thing ever since then, we've then followed other filmmakers who have bodies of work that tell a complete story. But we love to ask our interviewees, if there is a filmmaker, and it could be live action, who has a body of work that you think we should sit down and watch end to end and go on a journey with, who do you think of?
Well, if I have to talk about cinema in general, including live action, one comes to my head immediately, because he's probably, could be even the most well-known Spanish film director, but less known outside of Spain, because we always know about Buñuel, we know about Carlos Saura, we know about Almodóvar. But there's one director that started his career in the late 50s, and he was working, making films, you know, even in the 21st century, that is called Berlanga. Berlanga, he has made so many masterpieces. Imagine the work equivalent of Buñuel meets Billy Wilder.
Okay.
You know, and I'm talking about hits, if you ask, he's at the same level. There's not that I love more Fellini and Billy Wilder than Berlanga. You know, when they asked me about, you know, Sight and Sound asked me my top 10, you know, I had to put my top 10 of Berlanga, that is called The Executioner. Mm-hmm. It's a film that takes place from the early 60s, and it deals with the life of an executioner, you know, and it's a dramedy, it's a tragic comedy, but it's a full of humanity and full of humor. It went to Cannes, but I'm talking about, but he's very forgotten from the international film history, not in Spain. In Spain, we just adore Berlanga. So if you have this, I encourage the listeners, your film lovers, to look for Berlanga's film.
Perfect. I'll admit I'm completely ignorant. I've never heard of his work before, so I will be looking that up. Thank you so much, Pablo. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you for the podcast.
Thank you, Michael. I enjoyed it a lot.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Thanks to Pablo for speaking with me on the podcast this week. As I said, it was a long time coming, and I'm so glad we were able to have this conversation about the film, about sharing films with kids, about picture books, Spanish cinema, and so much in between. So much Ghibli chat as well, which is always a bonus. Let's run through a few of Pablo's recommendations. The picture books he recommended were Robinson Crusoe by Ajubel. I looked it up and it seems that you can get the Polish edition on Amazon, but I suppose if it's a wordless book, maybe it doesn't really matter what specific language version you're picking up. Also, there's Anna Juan's Circus. And at one point, Pablo also held up the book The Crocodile Blues, so look that one up too. As for films, he mentioned the Spanish animations Unicorn Wars, Bird Boy, and Buñuel and the Labyrinth of the Turtles. Unfortunately, I don't think any of those have actually had proper releases in the UK, but we should tip the hats to G-Kids in the States because they've released all of them over on that side of the Atlantic, so maybe you can import them if you want to watch them over here. Pablo's big recommendation was for the films of Luis García Berlanga, and particularly his film The Executioner from 1963. Pablo also mentioned his Sight and Sound top 10 a few times in that chat, so I thought it might be nice to read out his list here if you're curious to hear what other films made the cut. Of course, he mentioned Spirited Away and The Executioner were on his Sight and Sound list. There's also The Phantom Carriage by Victor Sjöström, Napoleon, the Abel Gance Napoleon, Singing in the Rain, La Strada, the Fellini film that he said that he loved sharing with his daughter, Dr. Strangelove, the Kubrick movie, The Tenant from Roman Polanski, Hannah and Her Sisters, Blue Velvet as well. I mean, it's a shame Jake couldn't make it for the chat in the end because I bet he would have loved going deeper on that David Lynch connection with Robot Dreams. But maybe we'll have a rematch with Pablo someday and we can talk about Blue Velvet. Anyway, that's it for this week. Here's a little tease for those of you who've stuck around this far. Jake and I are currently recording our next mini-series, which we'll look to announce soon, so look out for news about that. You can follow us on Twitter at GhibliAttack, Instagram at GhibliAttack.pod, or you can find us individually. Jake is Jake.H.Cunningham on Instagram or JakeHCunningham on Twitter. I'm Michael J. Leader on Twitter and Michael.Leader on Instagram. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.